The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
It's time now that we turn on for the lunchtime doctor, Dr. Brittany Dean, in the wings right here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1 and Sky 99.5. Good afternoon, Doc.
Good afternoon, Bass, and good afternoon to all our listeners out there. I hope everybody had an enjoyable and relaxing weekend. And I mean, we're back out to work and it's a new week, but of course we have very interesting topics coming up this week. And today's topic is going to be atrial fibrillation. And this is actually something that we do see quite often in Trinidad and Tobago. So it is important that people know about it, they know about the risk factors, how we manage it. And of course, while we are talking about this specific topic, anybody can feel free to call in and send their WhatsApp on any of their medical topics as well.
All right, beautiful. Yes, and just like the doc said, you could feel free to send in questions or call in when it's that time for any about any of your medical topics. Our number 625-2257, 627-3223, and of course 306-1065. So let's get into our topic. Exactly what is atrial fibrillation and how does it affect the heart's normal rhythm?
So atrial fibrillation, or AFib for short, it's actually an irregular heart rhythm that starts in the top chambers of the heart, which is called the atria. Now, normally the heart beats in a very regular, a very coordinated way, and the electrical signals make the atria and the ventricles, which are the lower chambers, pump blood in sync. Now, when we talk about AFib, the atria itself fires off rapid, chaotic electrical impulses, and it causes the heart to essentially beat irregularly and often much faster than normal. And that means that the heart is now not pumping blood as efficiently as it should be, and that is going to affect how well oxygen is delivered to the rest of the body. Now, for the person that is experiencing AFib, the irregular heartbeat may feel like a flutter or a racing heart or even a pounding in the chest. Some people will describe it as their heart skipping a beat or beating out of rhythm. Now, AFib itself is not immediately life-threatening in every single case, but the abnormal rhythm, it can lead to serious complications if it is not recognized and managed appropriately. Because remember, the blood flow inside of the heart is, it's going to become less smooth and less regular, and it's now going to be more prone to forming clots.
All right, and how common is AFib and who is most at risk of developing it?
So AFib is actually the most common sustained heart rhythm disorder worldwide. Apparently, there are studies now that are suggesting 1 in 4 adults over the age of 40 will develop atrial fibrillation at some point in their life. And the risk increases significantly with age, especially if somebody is older than 60 years old. And AFib is something that we see being slightly more common in men than women. But the women who do develop AFib, they tend to have a higher risk of stroke, and this now makes it a particularly important condition for both of the genders. Now, other groups that are at a higher risk would be the persons who have high blood pressure, the persons with heart disease, diabetes, obesity, who has a family history of heart rhythm disorders. And there are even certain lifestyle factors that contribute that we will get into later on. Now, in the Caribbean, because we have hypertension and diabetes being common, AFib is increasingly being seen as a major public health concern. And like I said before, we are increasingly seeing cases of AFib coming to the hospitals on a daily basis.
And what are the main causes of AFib, which is atrial fibrillation?
So AFib really doesn't have just one cause. It's usually because of damage or some sort of strain on the electrical system of the heart. The most common cause is if somebody has long-standing high blood pressure. And that is because if somebody has high blood pressure, that is going to make the heart work even harder to pump that blood around the body. And when, remember, the heart is a muscle. So when the heart is contracting and relaxing rapidly, and it is constantly doing that while working harder, it is going to get bigger. And this is enlarging the atria, or those chambers at the top of the heart. Now, other causes would be if somebody has heart valve problems or heart failure or even coronary artery disease. Even thyroid disorders are known to lead to AFib as well. And sometimes AFib can also be triggered by a surgery or severe infections and even stimulant drugs like cocaine. And that being said, it is important for people to note that AFib can occur even in people who have otherwise healthy hearts. And this is something we call lone atrial fibrillation. Now, in these cases, we usually see things like stress or excessive alcohol or even vigorous exercise sometimes being the trigger episodes. And this is really to show that AFib is a condition with multiple risk factors, and addressing any underlying health issues that a person may have is really the key in preventing or controlling it.
All right, folks, once again, if you just joined us, you're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor. In just about a couple minutes' time, we will be opening up the lines for your medical questions. Any of your medical questions at 625-2257, 627-3223. You could WhatsApp us at 306-1065, or feel free to message our friends at Sky or Sangeet, and they will send the messages right to us here in studio. So are there different types of AFibs?
So, yes, there's actually classifications into different types based on how long the irregular rhythm lasts for. So there's paroxysmal AFib, which essentially comes and goes on its own, and it will only last a few hours to days before the heart returns to a normal rhythm without treatment. And then we have persistent AFib, which lasts longer than 7 days, and it usually requires some sort of medical management to restore the heart to a normal rhythm. And then there is permanent AFib, when the irregular rhythm is always present, and any sort of attempts to restore normal rhythm have either failed or they're no longer pursued. Now, understanding the type of AFib is very important because, like I said, it helps to guide the sort of treatment that these persons will be placed on. Some people may only need short-term management if their AFib comes and goes, but others are going to need long-term management or medications or even procedures. Now, regardless of the type of AFib, all forms of AFib do carry a risk of certain complications like a stroke. So you cannot ignore any sort of irregular heart rhythm that you may be experiencing.
And what symptoms should people look out for?
So I would say the most common symptom is actually palpitations. So that feeling of a fluttering or a pounding or even a racing heartbeat. Some people also feel tired very easily. They may feel short of breath, lightheaded, even dizzy. And other people may experience things like a chest pain or a sense of anxiety when their heart is out of rhythm. Now, these symptoms can vary in intensity. Some people do have very dramatic episodes, but some others may just experience mild fatigue. Because AFib affects how well blood is essentially pumped around the body, these symptoms will often come on during some sort of activity. For example, if the person is climbing the stairs or if they're exercising. The danger, however, is really when AFib becomes or is silent, meaning that for some people there are no obvious symptoms at all. And that is why sometimes it can go undiagnosed until some sort of complication occurs along the way.
All right, folks, this is where we take some of your calls and your questions. I see calls coming in right away, so let's get them. Welcome to the Lunchtime Doctor. All right, we lost that one there. 625-2257, 6273-223, any of your medical questions. Hello, good afternoon.
This one.
Yeah.
My blessed doctor. This is a topic we had a couple of years ago in the camera meeting. I bring up this topic about the heart. What a pump. What an amazing piece of machinery God has made in our body. Because the day, this thing beating for 60, 70, 80 years, never stopped. The day this thing stopped, I said, you know. So I was wondering, doctor, exercise. I believe this is affecting. Exercise, you take a little drink now and then, red wine, you know what I mean? Party heart beating. But then, if it always low blood pressure, I believe low blood pressure could lead to affect. I'd like to hear your answer. Thanks a lot, doc.
So I believe I didn't really understand the question itself. How does exercise affect the heart, or how does low blood pressure affect the heart? I didn't really get the gist of the question, but in terms of exercise itself, when you essentially exercise regularly, your heart becomes a lot stronger, it becomes more resilient, and it becomes a lot more efficient. That means with each heartbeat now, it pumps more blood. So it essentially does not have to work as hard at rest, meaning that exercise helps you to lower your heart rate, it helps to improve your circulation, it helps to control your blood pressure, so it helps to really lower the blood pressure within the body to a normal and safe range. And it also raises your good cholesterol and lowers the bad cholesterol. So over time, all of these things help to reduce the risk of you developing heart disease, like heart attack, stroke, these different things.
All right, I think he was calling back there to clarify. Hello?
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
So I was saying, if a pressure always low, right, like that, people who have low blood pressure because they're lazy, they don't exercise and eat certain things, your heart has not a certain rhythm, right? And one day when your heart starts to be fast, like somebody running along to beat you or something, that might affect your heart because you have a certain rhythm to beat. And if you're not accustomed to beating fast, I believe that could affect. Thanks a lot, though.
Okay, I think I understand. I think I understand what he's trying to say. Now, having low blood pressure does not necessarily mean that a person is sedentary. In fact, having a low blood pressure, that is just something that happens to a lot of healthy, fit, even active people, especially young women, athletes. They would naturally have a lower pressure, and that is actually a sign that your heart is beating efficiently or is pumping blood efficiently. Now, remember, when you have a high blood pressure, and I think that we tend to confuse blood pressure with our heart rate. And yes, there is a sort of correlation, but it is not the same thing. Your heart will beat faster so that it can pump blood more efficiently around the body when you're in a fight or flight mode, and that will cause blood to be efficiently taken to the places that it needs to be taken to. So say you're running away, it will be taken to the legs to help you run faster. But at your resting heart rate, your blood pressure should not be high, because imagine your heart beating against very stiff arteries. It's going to have to work extra hard to try to pump that blood through these very, very stiff arteries throughout your body. And that is going to cause strain on the heart. And that is what leads to these chambers becoming larger and leads to things like atrial fibrillation, like we're talking about.
All right, question here. This AFib, can asthma cause this disease?
So asthma and AFib, they are not really related, because asthma is a respiratory condition and AFib is more of an electrical system of the heart condition. But asthma can be linked to AFib fibrillation, but usually indirectly. So asthma is not something that directly causes AFib. There's no direct correlation, but people with asthma do appear to have a higher risk of developing an abnormal heart rhythm, including AFib.
Now, there's a story in the news today, Doctor, where a pregnant woman, a woman unaware of pregnancy, gives birth at events, and all other people were discussing it. Is it possible to be pregnant and you are not aware of it?
Yeah, that is actually something that occurs. I mean, albeit it is very rare for somebody to not know that they are pregnant, but being unaware of a pregnancy is something that can happen. Like, I would say one in probably 400, 500 pregnancies, and one in 2,500 pregnancies at delivery, like what happened to this lady. So this happens because some people may have irregular or absent symptoms of pregnancy. They may have their normal periods, even the body type of the woman, or even the positioning of the baby. In some women, their weight distribution or the baby's position may hide that bump. And if somebody is not pregnant, especially if their body just continues along the normal lines, like having their period, etc.
All right, here's a question. We do get some questions here. Is walking good? My doctor told me to walk. You should walk.
Yes, walking is absolutely amazing. So walking is good in terms of strengthening your heart, lowering your blood pressure, improving your circulation. Even short walks after your meals, like 5 to 10 minute walks, that helps to reduce your blood sugar spikes and it lowers your diabetes risk. And of course, in the interim, you're also burning calories, so it helps with weight management in a very steady way. And once it's low impact walking, it is protective for the joints, so it helps to protect the knees and the hips. And of course, while you're walking, we can't forget the mental health. It does help to reduce your stress hormones and boost your mood as well.
All right, folks, we'll be getting back to some more of your questions in just a short while. Remember our number, 625-2257, 627-3223. WhatsApp 3061065. And remember, you could send your messages to Sky or Sangeet and they will send it to us right here in studio. So can AFib occur without any symptoms at all?
So yes, this is actually one of the reasons why AFib can become so dangerous. Up to one third of people with AFib actually have no noticeable symptoms at all. And this is what we termed silent AFib. A person may feel perfectly fine, but still be at risk for forming blood clots inside of the heart. And that those blood clots can travel to the brain and cause a stroke. In fact, some people only discover they have AFib after having suffered a stroke or even heart failure. And that is why, you know, your regular health checkups become very important, especially if you have risk factors like hypertension or diabetes, or you're older than 60 years old. These things become so important because you never know what is going on with your body until you get it properly assessed and evaluated. Even if you feel well, you know, having that simple pulse check, doing a simple blood pressure machine reading, or even an ECG during your routine visit to your doctor, those things can help to pick up AFib easily before it starts to cause any sort of serious damage.
Okay, and why is AFib considered dangerous if left untreated?
The biggest danger with AFib is stroke. So when the atria or those top chambers of the heart, when they become sort of quivering instead of pumping properly, the blood can now pool inside of that chamber. And when blood stays stagnant for a long period of time, it's going to form clots. If a clot breaks loose and it travels to the brain, it is going to cause a stroke. And that can lead to disability or even death in some cases. People with AFib, they are about 5 times more likely to have a stroke than persons without AFib. Another major complication or danger that we do see with AFib is heart failure, because the heart is beating irregularly and oftentimes it is beating too fast. So the pumping chambers of the heart now, they become weak and they become less efficient over time. And that can lead to symptoms of heart failure like swelling in the legs, extreme fatigue, shortness of breath. So AFib itself may not always feel dramatic for some people, but the consequences like the stroke and the heart failure, it can be debilitating and it can even be life-threatening in some cases.
And how is atrial fibrillation diagnosed by a doctor?
So the most common and the most reliable test is an electrocardiogram or ECG as we know it. And that is essentially what records the electrical activity of the heart, and it will show any sort of irregular rhythm. Sometimes, because AFib does come and go in some people, a single ECG might miss it. And in those cases, your doctor may use something called a Holter monitor or an event recorder. And these are small devices that are worn by the patient for 24 hours or even longer to capture the heart's rhythm over time. And of course, we have to rely on a careful history of the patient, a physical exam of the patient, and that will involve checking their pulse, which in AFib feels irregular and sometimes fast. And of course, there are blood tests that can be performed, but that's really to look for underlying medical conditions like thyroid disease. And echocardiograms, which are essentially the ultrasounds of the heart, they are also used to look at the structure of the heart itself and how well the heart is functioning. So altogether, the ECG, your history, your examination, and even your blood tests, these tests tend to confirm the diagnosis and will be able to help guide.
And how is AFib well diagnosed by a doctor?
So, like I just mentioned, you know, we look at the history, the physical exam, we check the pulse, and of course, we do an ECG. And in some persons, they may require that Holter monitor because sometimes you may miss the actual rhythm, because for some people, AFib does come and go. And of course, blood tests can be done to rule out other conditions like thyroid disease. And echocardiograms can also be done, which is the ultrasound of the heart, to assess the structure and function.
What lifestyle factors can increase the risk of developing AFib?
So there are several lifestyle habits that can either trigger AFib or can make it worse. Heavy alcohol use, especially binge drinking, that is strongly linked, so much so that there's actually a nickname for it, and it's called holiday heart syndrome. So sometimes, maybe after carnival, after a fete, we'll find some young persons who have been drinking excessively coming with heart palpitations and irregular heart rhythms, and we call this holiday heart syndrome. Now, obesity, smoking, a sedentary lifestyle, all of these things also increase the risk because they contribute to high blood pressure and diabetes, which in turn places a strain on the person's heart. Poor sleep, particularly in persons who have sleep apnea, is another major factor that we sometimes overlook. Now, stress, high caffeine intake, these things are sometimes blamed as well. Caffeine alone by itself will really cause AFib in healthy people. But in those who are predisposed to AFib, too much caffeine may be a contributing factor. Now, the takeaway is that you may not be able to control every single risk factor like your age or your family history, but lifestyle modifications really do go a long way in prevention and management of AFib.
All right, folks, let's take a break to answer some more of your questions again. 625-2257. Remember, any of your medical questions right here, I did see some calls coming in there while the doctor was speaking. 627-3223. WhatsApp us at 3061065 or send your messages to Sangeet or Sky and you will send it right to us here in studio. All right, of course, you're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor, Mondays to Wednesdays right here. Good day, doctor. If you did a routine echo sound test and it came back normal, is this a good sign that your heart is okay?
So if you did a routine echocardiogram, which is essentially the ultrasound of the heart, and what the echo does is essentially it shows you the structure of your heart as well as how well it is functioning. It is a good indicator that the results are normal, but of course you have to ensure that you get your ECG done to look at the electrical activity of the heart and of course monitor for any symptoms along the way and get your routine checkup as needed.
All right, we do have a call. I received this call coming in here. All right, let's wait a couple of seconds for them to call back. 625-2257. 627-3223. Making sure everybody gets in on the program for today. All right? 627-3223, 625-2257. Lunchtime Doctor, line 2. Let's go. Hello, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon. I know this is not the program first, right? But what happened?
So this is our medical, a medical program, sir?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Yeah, let's go line 1. Let's go line 1 again, 625-2257, 627-3223 for your medical questions. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm the doctor. Doctor, between my leg and my groin, it's swollen. And I don't know if somebody is hernia. Can you tell me what we call that?
All right.
So if it is between the leg and groin, or what we usually call the inguinal region, there are several possibilities. And I think the most common one that we may look at is actually an inguinal hernia, where essentially you have parts of the intestine or fatty tissue that pushes through a weak spot in your abdominal wall, and it creates this bulge in the groin. And it can also be enlarged lymph nodes, because you do have lymph nodes near the groin area which can swell because of infection or inflammation. It could be an infection or abscess, but you have to monitor these symptoms. Especially
went out there, doc. Hello? Had a little drop in transmission there, doctor?
Especially if it's red and warm or very tender. If the swelling is very sudden and firm and even painful, please go and get it assessed. And if you get any fever, redness or pus, you need to make sure that you are getting it properly assessed, or if there's any sort of groin pain as well. And if the swelling is not going away at all after a few weeks.
All right, let's try this line 2. Hello, good afternoon. Hello?
Hi, good day, doctor. And to you. My skin on my couple of spots, little white spots. I don't think it's vitiligo, but it's some little white spot. What would she advise about that?
Yeah, where did white spots located again?
All on your leg. All on my
leg.
Upper leg.
So when we look at white spots on the leg, it can be due to many different conditions. It could be idiopathic, meaning like sometimes it's just related to sun exposure and skin aging, and they would usually appear on like the shins or the forearms of people as they age, but some people do get it on the legs themselves. Vitiligo is also an autoimmune condition where we can see those white spots. It could be a fungal infection, tinea versicolor, and sometimes we call that in the Caribbean luter. But that is, like I said, because we're in the Caribbean, the warm, humid climates do tend to make us more prone to that. It could be that you're just having hypopigmentation, so after some sort of trauma to the skin, some people may have post-inflammatory hypopigmentation. Now, you may want to look at, depending on what the cause is, there are different treatments. So I would suggest that you go to a dermatologist to find out the exact cause. And if it is idiopathic due to sun exposure, etc., wearing sunscreen will help. If it's vitiligo, a dermatologist evaluation is very important. And again, if it's tinea versicolor, then of course you need to be treated with certain antifungals.
All right, good day, doctor. What is the difference between, is there a difference between joint pain and arthritis, and how old or how young can you get arthritis at a young age? I'm 36 years old with a lot of joint pain.
So when we look at joint pain and arthritis, joint pain can result from many different things. So you can have overuse of the joint, you can have an infection, you can have an inflammation, or even muscle strain around the joint. For example, if somebody twists their knee while exercising, they may get joint pain without having arthritis. And it's sometimes temporary after that heavy workout or some sort of sporting event. And it usually resolves with rest and ice or short-term medication. Joint pain is really a symptom, but it's not really a diagnosis. It just means that something is wrong, but you don't have an underlying cause that may or may not be arthritis. Now, arthritis is an actual condition where the joint itself becomes very inflamed or damaged or undergoing degeneration. And there are hundreds of types of arthritis. And the most common we know is osteoarthritis. So that will create chronic joint symptoms, not just pain, but swelling and stiffness and redness over the area, and sometimes even loss of function. So arthritis is more of a chronic condition of the joint itself, while joint pain can be short-term and caused by many different things. And you can get arthritis at any age, actually. So even in your 30s, if you've had some sort of overuse, or if you've had some sort of trauma, some people do develop arthritis at a very young age, especially if they've had some sort of injury at a young age as well. But I do suggest that if you are getting it in one specific area, go and get it properly assessed, because it could just be that you've had some sort of injury to that area that needs care.
And let's see if we get one more call in there. Hello, good afternoon. All right, we lost that one. 625-257-6273-223. Let's try. Hello, good afternoon.
There's no time to...
Mm-hmm.
Doc, I still baffle, you know. A woman gets pregnant, you make a baby. She still is, no? So what about your monthly cycle? What about your swelling? Your baby never grew? I mean, yes, maybe it's a robot.
It's not a robot, but like the doctor said, it is possible. And it's true that sometimes the baby could be even in there. They say like sometimes in your back, and then for you may not get the usual swelling of the tummy that you're accustomed to.
Yeah, so we usually call something like that a cryptic pregnancy. It's being very unaware, and sometimes it just occurs. It's irregular or absent symptoms. some women will continue to bleed like they're having normal periods. And like I said, the body position, the body type of the woman and the position of the baby also play a role. If the baby is positioned towards the back, the belly may not appear as large.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get another call. Hello, good afternoon. Hello?
Yes. Hello. What is the symptoms of one who has, they say, have fatty liver? What are the symptoms?
Symptoms of a fatty liver. All right.
So when you're looking at a fatty liver, this is, in medical terms, hepatic steatosis. Now, this is when excess fat builds up in the liver cells, and there's two types. You have the alcoholic fatty liver, and then you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And oftentimes, people actually have no symptoms at all. A lot of people only find this out through some sort of ultrasound or routine blood test. But when they present, some people may have tiredness or fatigue. They may have general feelings of weakness. They may have a discomfort in the upper right side of the abdomen. They may have changes in their weight. And in more advanced cases, when there's inflammation or when there's scarring, their liver may become enlarged. They may have loss of appetite, nausea. But most of the time, we don't actually get any symptoms with fatty liver disease.
All right, let's return to our topic of atrial fibrillation. And how is it actually treated?
So when we look at the treatment, there are three main goals. And the three main goals really are to control the patient's heart rate, to restore or maintain a normal rhythm, and to prevent complications like stroke. Rate control is often something that is done with medications like your beta blockers or your calcium channel blockers. And this is something that you would also be, you would also see being used as blood pressure medications. Rhythm control may involve certain medications as well, or even electrical cardioversion, which is a controlled shock to reset the heart rhythm, or even more advanced procedures like catheter ablation, which basically targets the abnormal electrical pathways in the atria itself. For some people who have persistent AFib, especially those who don't respond to medications, then pacemakers or surgical approaches may actually be needed in those cases. And treatment is very highly individualized. Some people may do well with medications alone. Other people may need other procedures to restore that normal rhythm. But it is important to note that all patients need to be evaluated for stroke prevention.
And what role do blood thinners play in the AFib management, and why are they important?
So blood thinners, also called anticoagulation, they are one of the most parts of AFib treatment. Because AFib increases the risk of blood clots and stroke, blood thinners actually reduce that risk dramatically because it prevents the clot formation in the atria. People may be may be familiar with the common medications like warfarin, and there are newer drugs on the market like the apixaban and the rivaroxaban, and these things are often easier to use and they may require less monitoring than the warfarin. People tend to think that blood thinners are the cure to AFib, and that is not true. They do not fix your rhythm, but they prevent the most dangerous complication, which is stroke. And the choice of whether somebody needs to be placed on blood thinners is made based on a stroke risk and certain factors like age, high blood pressure, diabetes, or if they've had a prior history of stroke.
All right, folks, once again, you're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor. We'll see if we can squeeze in a couple more questions before we leave, so just hold on. And is AFib reversible or curable, or is it a long-term condition?
For some people, AFib is temporary and reversible if the underlying cause is treated. For example, if AFib is triggered by an overactive thyroid or an infection or excessive alcohol intake, it may go away once that trigger is properly managed. Cardioversion, which is that shocking, and ablation procedures, it can also restore normal rhythm in many patients, and sometimes that can be a permanent fix. But for a lot of other patients, AFib is a chronic condition that does require lifelong management. The goal then is not always to cure it, but to control the symptoms and to ensure that you're properly protecting the heart and preventing the major complications like stroke. AFib is manageable, and with the proper treatment, a lot of people do live normal, long, healthy lives.
And what lifestyle changes can help reduce the frequency or severity of AFib episodes?
So lifestyle really does play a big role in AFib management. Maintaining a healthy weight, eating a balanced diet that is rich in fruits and vegetables and lean proteins, and of course exercising regularly, all of these things can reduce the strain on the heart. Limiting your alcohol and quitting smoking are also very crucial. And for the people who do have sleep apnea, using a CPAP machine at night can dramatically lower the risk of AFib episodes. Stress management is equally as important. So your practices like yoga and meditation and deep breathing, these things can help to reduce the episodes for some persons as well. And of course, cutting back on the highly caffeinated drinks will help the people who are very sensitive to caffeine. And yes, medication and the proper procedures are very much important, but lifestyle changes are just as powerful in reducing the burden of AFib in a person who is diagnosed with it.
Before we get into some more questions, what are some myths or misconceptions about AFib that people should be aware of?
I think that one common myth that people have is that AFib is harmless because it's just an irregular heartbeat. And that's along the lines of dangerous thinking, because AFib can be very much silent, but the risk of stroke and heart failure is very much real. Another myth is that only older people get AFib. Age really is a major risk factor, but younger people, especially the ones who have obesity or sleep apnea or heavy alcohol use, they can also develop it as well. And people tend to think that once you've been diagnosed, you will never live normally again. The truth is, many people live full, active lives with AFib as long as they get the appropriate treatment and they make the appropriate healthy lifestyle choices. So, you know, awareness and proper management, they really are the key to staying safe when you're diagnosed with AFib.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's see if we could get some more questions. I have a call coming in here. Hello, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Yeah, speak up a little bit, please, so we can hear you.
I say I have a problem, and the doctor can help me, please. I had a excessive blood circulation, but what happened from the whole foot get dark, and experience and let it go a kind of light, dead skin like. Could you help me on that, please?
Did you hear that, Doc?
Yes.
Okay.
And when we're looking at, the color of the leg becoming much darker, this really leads us to believe that, you know, the circulation problem is really becoming complicated now. Now, this hyperpigmentation, and we usually see this with probably chronic venous insufficiency when your leg veins themselves, they don't work properly and they don't return the blood properly to the heart. Now, the iron from that blood starts to pool under the skin and leaves a very brownish and purplish stain. And the dead skin patches means that there's lack of blood flow, means that there's poor healing and loss of healthy tissue in that area. Now, it could be a chronic venous insufficiency. It could be peripheral arterial disease. It could be diabetes. There are many different things that can lead to this. My top advice here would be to please go and get your leg checked out. Let them do, you know, even an ultrasound of the leg just to ensure that you have no blood clots in the leg. And some of the lifestyle things that you can do is exercise regularly, maintain a healthy weight, control diabetes or blood pressure if you are diagnosed with any of those things. But please go and get your leg checked out.
All right, wonderful program. My question is, are there medical preparations derived from petroleum products? And if so, what are the complications involved in being exposed to these products?
When we're looking at petroleum products, the main one I could think of is petroleum jelly. But in terms of actual prescription medications, certain mineral oils, like, yes, liquid paraffin, if I'm not mistaken, paraffin wax, even any sort of paraffin-based ointments or creams. Now, there are some risks in terms of your skin not responding well to it. Petroleum jelly is generally safe, but non-purified petroleum products that are not medical-grade products, they may contain certain impurities, and that can be harmful. Even overuse of very greasy ointments can block your pores, and it could lead to acne or folliculitis. If you start to ingest these things like the mineral oils long term, that can interfere with the absorption of some of your vitamins. And I mean, really and truly, those are the main risks that I could think of off the bat. But really and truly, most of the ones that you're using are medical grade products, and they have been properly tested.
Okay, what would you say would cause a heart rate of 38 to 40 BPM? A person of average health, normal ECG, stress test normal, and Holter normal.
So the person has a heart rate of 38 to 40, and this is usually considered bradycardia, meaning that it is slower than normal. In a normal adult, your resting heart rate can be between 60 to 100, but bradycardia can also be normal in some cases. For example, in an athlete who is well-conditioned. So well-trained athletes often have heart rates in their 40s or even high 30s because their heart muscle is so efficient, and this is harmless if there are no symptoms. During deep sleep, your heart rate will naturally slow and may dip into the 30s during relaxation or meditation. But if everything else is normal, I would say it's one of those three. Maybe you have very good athletic conditioning, or maybe you're just in a relaxed state most of the time. But there are medical causes that can lead to bradycardia, like sick sinus syndrome, heart blocks, you know, certain medications that you may be taking. But again, if everything else is normal, it could just be your normal in terms of athletic conditioning.
5 minutes away from 1 o'clock. Let's get this question here. Hello, good afternoon.
Yes, no question to the doctor, because right now I do not have a doctor. Is the doctor available to see patients? If so, where can I contact, and where?
Want to know where can they contact the doctor?
You can feel free to send my number. If the person can just send you a WhatsApp. And my offices are usually in Trincity or Freeport.
All right, Trincity or Freeport. Okay, so let's get our final question here on AFib. All right. What advice would you give to someone who has been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation?
So the first thing to note is don't panic. You know, AFib is common. You are not alone in this journey. with modern treatments now, many people manage their conditions very well. The most important step is to follow up regularly with your doctor, take your medications as it is prescribed, and get checked for your stroke risk. Now, if a blood thinner is recommended, you need to understand why it is crucial and be compliant with the medication. The second piece of advice I would have is really to take control of your lifestyle. Make sure that you are exercising on a daily basis. Make sure that you're eating healthy, balanced meals. Make sure that you are sleeping appropriately. And if you have sleep apnea, you are getting yourself properly diagnosed and using your CPAP machine. And cut back on any of the negative habits like the smoking or the heavy drinking. And pay attention to your mental health as well, because somebody who's diagnosed with anxiety, that can sometimes make your AFib symptoms a lot worse. So with the right care, with the right adjustments, people with AFib live very long, very healthy, and very fulfilling lives.
Since we have just about 2.5 more minutes, there was a WhatsApp that came in here. A lengthy question. Let's see if we could get it on.
Hi, good day again. I have this to say, Penelope Beckles. I have great respect for her, but
this is not a medical question. All right, so 2 minutes away from 1 o'clock. So anything you'd like to say about maybe our topic for tomorrow, Doc, or anything closing off with the, yeah.
So maybe for tomorrow's topic, maybe we can discuss hernias, because somebody called in with a hernia, and I don't think that we've discussed that topic previously, but it is something that is very, very common, and a lot of people may even have hernias and may not even know that they have hernias. So it is something that I think that is good for people to know about, know your risk factors, know how we manage it, and know how to prevent it as well.
All right, very well. And there may be even a guest on this, you know, being pregnant, and you may not know, because it is a trending topic that a lot of people are talking about.
Oh, yes, right. Yes. I can possibly get one of my obs and gyne colleagues to come speak about that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much. You've been listening to The Lunchtime Doctor. Remember, as always, we're on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangeet 106.1 and Sky 99.5. Mondays to Wednesdays, 12 noon, right after the news, to 1 p.m. All right, so feel free, get your medical questions up and join us, and we'll chat tomorrow. Right, do enjoy the rest of your day.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.